Hello, this is Becky Lewis, welcoming you to episode 9 of the West Virginia Leaders of Literacy podcast. In this episode, I'm being joined with my co-host for the month, Brittany Fike. Our conversation will be centered around childhood trauma and ways that educators can create trauma-informed classrooms. Welcome to the West Virginia Leaders of Literacy podcast, where we engage in educational conversations to strengthen early literacy in West Virginia. Are you ready to become a leader of literacy? Hello, everyone. I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited to introduce my colleague who is making her debut appearance on the podcast today, Brittany Fike. Brittany has experience working in the classroom with students from preschool to fifth grade. Her background in elementary and early childhood education has led her to her passion for helping those in the education community to provide the best opportunities possible for all children. She holds a bachelor's degree in elementary education, as well as a master's degree in special education, and is now working on her doctorate degree in curriculum and instruction. Brittany is a state early literacy specialist working on the West Virginia Campaign for Grade Level Reading. This is her first year working on the campaign. She is excited to use her background and experience to help strengthen the learning opportunities for all children in our state. Brittany, thank you so much for co-hosting with me this month.
Thank you so much, Becky. I'm happy to be here for today's episode.
So this month's topic is childhood trauma, and our goal for the next two episodes is to help other educators out there gain a better understanding of what childhood trauma is and how to create trauma-informed classrooms. And to me, this feels like such a critical topic for us to be discussing right now.
Yes, I agree. It definitely is an important topic. Did you know that it's estimated that 1/2 to 2/3 of children experience trauma?
Really? Can you just repeat that one more time for me?
Yes, 1/2 to 2/3 of children experience trauma.
So if we're thinking of a class of 20 kids, that's between 10 and 15 of those children have experienced trauma or are experiencing it now.
That's exactly right.
Let's turn and talk about the article that we're going to be referencing today. This article comes from the Education Law Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the title of it is Unlocking the Door to Learning, Trauma-Informed Classroom in Transformational Schools. Listeners, you can find this link to the article in the show notes.
Yes, thank you for sharing, Becky. This is a wonderful article. It's full of quick facts, research, recommendations, all surrounding trauma. And I'm really excited to talk with you about it today.
Me too. I'm really excited because they, like you said, there are some great facts and information in there for educators. So the first step for educators when it comes to trauma is to understand what it is, who experiences it, why, and the overall impact that it has on a child's ability to learn. So to make sure that me and you and our audience is all on the same page, Brittany, can you start by defining trauma according to the article?
Absolutely. So trauma is a negative response to an event or even a series of events that a child experiences that surpasses their typical coping skills. It can come in many forms, and what can be defined as a traumatic experience for one child might not necessarily be the same for another child. Trauma can affect a child in many ways, including even impacting their brain development.
I think that it's so important to keep that in mind, what you just said, but especially for us to keep it in mind as educators, that trauma comes in so many forms and it looks different from child to child, and also that anyone can experience trauma. It really has no boundaries.
Yes, you're correct. Anyone can experience trauma. children from all races, all socioeconomic backgrounds can be impacted. And just as we mentioned earlier, research shows that between 1/2 and 2/3 of all school-age children have been exposed to one or more adverse childhood experiences that have then led to trauma. So just take a second to think about your own classroom and your students and how many students that would be that are impacted. Mm-hmm. Not only is their experience different or what happened to them different, but also the ways in which they are attempting to cope looks different for every student.
And I want to talk about those adverse childhood effects for a minute. And we know them in the education world as ACEs. But in particularly, I want to talk about one well-known study that refers to these adverse childhood experiences or ACEs. And what this study has done is it has linked these ACEs to many common adult medical and psychological problems. So Brittany, can you go over what some of these events are that would be considered as traumatic experiences?
Sure. Some examples of those events could be physical or emotional abuse. It could be neglect, witnessed violence. It could be that a child is living with someone who is mentally ill or suicidal or who is a substance abuser. It could also be the sudden death of someone they were close with, a serious hospitalization or illness of the child or of someone that they're close to, or it could just be a major accident. Just keep in mind that those are examples. So that doesn't mean that every child who experiences these things will experience trauma as a result. And it also doesn't mean that there are not other experiences that could lead to a child being impacted by trauma.
Right. And I think that's so important for us educators to remember that a traumatic experience for one child does not mean that it's necessarily traumatic for another and has the same impact. So when a child does have an adverse experience that leads to trauma, the impact of that trauma, though, can interfere with brain development, learning, and behavior. We know that children are constantly developing, and because of this and their experiences, both good ones and bad ones, it shapes their development. Research shows that our brain continues to develop all the way up into early adulthood, with some of the most crucial times of brain development being during adolescence and early childhood.
Yeah, that's right. Our brains are constantly developing, especially in those young years. So think about children who experience trauma during those crucial times of development and what it does for their brain function.
Right. And some of the things that happens to those children who experience trauma, like you were saying, during these crucial times, is that it changes the way that the brain functions. It can change the whole structure and functioning through the activation of the stress response system. So when we are exposed to a stressor, our bodies naturally respond through a fight, flight, or freeze response that activates several other systems in our body, and it also releases stress hormones that are designed for us to protect ourselves for survival.
Yes.
This response, though, if it's repeated through too many exposures, it can be dangerous to the brain. So rather than being a protective mechanism, what it can do is it can lead to an overreactive stress system. So children who experience trauma on a more repeated basis and are living in a constant state of emergency and their bodies enter that fight, flight, or freeze, they enter it more rapidly and more frequently than children who are not living in that constant state of emergency.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And when we're talking about brain function, this is something that's not mentioned in the article, but Dr. Dan Siegel has done some powerful and important work surrounding trauma in the brain. He uses a wonderful hand model, and it helps explain what happens to our brain when it's triggered by trauma. So if you want to kind of create a visual with me, If you face your palm towards you and then you make a fist with your thumb tucked inside your fingers, this creates that hand model of the brain. And the wrist area represents the automatic portion of your brain. So this is the part of your brain that controls all the functions of your body that you don't have to think about. So that would be like your heart rate, your breathing, or your temperature. And then your fingers represent your thinking brain. So this is where our ability to reason comes from. It's where we develop skills like organization, flexibility, patience, time management. And then lastly, your thumb represents your emotional brain. So this is where emotions and memories are processed. And it's also what drives that flight, fight, or freeze response that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So when someone is feeling sad or mad or angry, connections between the thinking brain and the emotional brain aren't working well. So this might be what a temper tantrum looks like in a young child. And when your fist is closed, it shows that your brain is working in harmony. All the parts are talking and working together as they should be. When you open your fist or flip your lid, as Dr. Siegel says, the upper and lower parts of the brain are no longer communicating, and you're not able to access that logical problem-solving part of your brain. So when a child who has experienced trauma, their emotions override their ability to think clearly, and those parts of the brain are no longer talking, and that's when they flip their lid.
And I really love this visual model because it not only helps adults understand, but it helps children understand the connection between how the brain works and their feelings. So when a child has flipped their lid, these are the actions that we see in the classrooms, and we often deem them as defiant and disrespectful.
That's right. In this state, the different parts of the brain are disconnected and not working together, and those emotional parts of the brain have taken charge. I know that even as an adult, I've been guilty of those emotional parts of my brain taking over and my lid flipping. And in a child, this oftentimes leads to them being quick to anger or leaving them as seeming inattentive. And then, like you said, those children are seen as being defiant or just shutting down. But really, what is happening is their brain's telling them that they need to be safe and protect themselves, and their responses are a result of that.
And I hope this really makes it easier for our audience, because I know it makes it easier for me to understand how children process their experiences and the things that have happened to them. It also allows me to see when a child is having a hard time paying attention, following directions, or learning some kind of new information, that it might be because of the way their brain has been impacted by trauma. But something important to keep in mind is trauma not only impacts learning experiences of students, it impacts other areas as well.
That's right. Trauma impacts all sorts of different things. And one of those things is the way that children interact with each other. We know that currently many classroom environments are structured in a way that promotes teamwork and collaboration. I know in my personal experience as a classroom educator, every year it was my goal to create a safe physical and emotional environment that thrives on students becoming really like a family, where they could form close relationships in order to learn from each other and grow together. And for students who have experienced trauma, who have trouble interacting with their peers, trusting others and forming relationships might be difficult. So in that type of classroom environment, like I mentioned, they're likely to struggle. And in these situations, it's important to remember how that child's brain is working and what they need in order to cope with how they're feeling.
And I really appreciate that that was your goal every year, to make sure that you were creating both that physical and emotional environment, because it's very important. Because childhood trauma often has long-term effects that impact our students. And children who experience trauma as adults and adolescents, they're at a higher risk for mental and physical problems, abusing substances, and also becoming a part of the criminal justice system. So when we're in the classroom, it really can be a challenge for educators to shift that mindset from focusing on the behavior that a student has who has experienced trauma to really understanding what they've been through.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And that is one of my favorite things that the article talks about and does a great job of addressing. We have to understand that there is a cycle of trauma, which is the thought that when students display those unwanted behaviors related to past experiences, that they can become re-traumatized for punishment of those behaviors, which then in turn just continues the cycle of behavior problems. So in order to break that cycle, we really have to focus on asking what has happened to this child and what have they been through, rather than what's wrong with this child. And that in turn will help lessen those long-term impacts and help us to become trauma-informed.
And that's really key, is breaking those cycles, because we know how important it is to break poverty cycles, but it's also really important to break the trauma cycles as well.
Yes.
And I know there's a lot of talk about trauma-informed schools, but I want to make sure our audience knows what that means. So a trauma-informed school is exactly what it sounds like. It's a school community that is prepared to recognize and respond appropriately to those children who have been impacted by trauma. And the article mentions several models that have been developed in order to help schools and school systems become trauma-informed.
Yes, Becky, that's a great definition of trauma-informed schools. And according to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, there are 10 key elements of a trauma-informed school. And the article we're talking about today mentions 7 of those elements, but since research has been updated, they now are addressing 10 key elements of a trauma-informed school. And I'll just briefly mention them to you. Identifying and assessing traumatic stress and addressing and treating that stress. Teaching trauma education and awareness. Having partnerships with students and families. Creating a trauma-informed learning environment. Being culturally responsive. Integrating emergency management and crisis response, understanding and addressing staff self-care and secondary traumatic stress, evaluating and revising school discipline policies and practices, and lastly, collaborating across systems and establishing community partnerships.
And that can seem like a really heavy lift, but I want to let you know that the National Childhood Traumatic Stress Network also has a free framework tool on their website that has been put together for schools and school systems to use for implementation. But Brittany, I want to go to ask you the question. If it sounds like it's a heavy lift for our listeners, what could you say to them to help it seem lighter, and where to start?
Yeah, well, like you said, the National Child Traumatic Stress Network has that free framework. And so there are lots of great resources out there that can help you work towards becoming trauma-informed. And I think it's important to remember a few things. First would be that it takes a village. So even though your school may not be working towards becoming trauma-informed as a whole, you can start in your classroom by working to become a trauma-informed teacher. And I think it's just so important to keep in mind that, like we've talked about, any student can be affected by trauma. We sometimes tend to think of trauma as only affecting students of a certain race or socioeconomic status, but it's crucial to keep in mind that anyone can experience a negative event that leads to trauma. And you may not always know who these students are, but the research shows that they are there and they're in our classrooms. So just like we talked about, and again, like the article mentions, we tend to ask what is wrong with a student who is exhibiting unwanted behaviors, but we really need to be asking what has happened to them. And I think that with that shift in mindset, that's a great and crucial first step.
I completely agree with that. And I know for educators who feel like they may have already had that shift in mindset, the article lists several recommendations for them for becoming more trauma-informed. And I'm just going to go over those really quickly. The first recommendation is that educators learn to recognize the symptoms of children who've experienced trauma. Because children can react to trauma in different ways, And the most important thing that you can do is to be sensitive to the signs of potential trauma. Second is, if it's at all possible, obtain a trauma history for a new student or a student coming to your classroom from the previous grade. If that's not possible, try to complete an annual screening process that either assesses directly or indirectly for trauma. And that will help move you towards becoming more trauma informed.
I think that's a great recommendation. And also, in regard to obtaining a trauma history, I think one of the best ways that you can do that is by forming those close relationships with your students.
Right. Those relationships really are key to not only those who have been affected by trauma, but just to building that positive classroom culture and climate.
Definitely.
Another thing we can do as teachers is avoid re-traumatizing by knowing what triggers a child and avoid punitive action. Because as teachers, we're pretty good at observing and we can usually figure out what sets a child off. And if we punish them for something that's a trigger, it's only going to cause them to spiral and re-traumatize them.
Yes, and that's how we continue that cycle of trauma that we were talking about needing to break.
Exactly. The fourth recommendation is to build school community partnerships with mental health organizations. And I know a lot of counties in our state are starting to do that. And what they are doing through these partnerships oftentimes is these mental health organizations are able to actually come into the schools and provide services there for the students rather than the students having to be taken to an appointment by a parent.
Yes, we're seeing more and more of our schools and our counties partner with those mental health organizations, and I think that is just the most wonderful thing.
I think so too. And the very last thing that the article recommends is that educators just learn more about various trauma-informed models. There are many different models out there, and just research, look them up, see what's been developed, and consider adopting one.
Yes, there are so many great resources out there on trauma-informed schools and different models that have already been developed. There are also some great recommendations for administrators who can work to help their school becoming more trauma-informed. The article lists a lot of great resources on trauma-informed approaches and trauma-specific interventions.
Yeah, I feel like we could spend a whole week on this topic every day and not dig deep enough.
I agree.
As our time's winding down, Brittany, I really want to take a second just to thank you for being here today and talking trauma.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask you your final question. We know that being a leader of literacy encompasses more than just teaching a child to read. So I would like to ask you, Brittany, what is one tip or piece of advice around trauma that you can give our listeners about being a leader of literacy?
I think my advice would be similar to what we were just discussing, and we have to remember to ask ourselves what happened to our students who have experienced trauma rather than asking what is wrong with them. I think this is absolutely crucial for breaking the cycle of trauma and is a great first step in becoming trauma-informed. In order for our students to learn, they first have to feel safe and supported, and we owe it to our students to provide that sense of security. So not only we break that cycle of trauma and prevent future trauma, but also we give them the skills needed to cope with how they are feeling.
For links to all the resources discussed in today's episode and for additional information, please visit our website at wvde.us/leaders of literacy and click on the show notes for this episode. For additional information on childhood trauma, please visit wvde.us/reclaimwv. Want to learn more about being a leader of literacy? Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single installment. Be on the lookout for our upcoming episode on childhood trauma, where we will be welcoming guest and expert, Anna Rowe. She will be discussing the impacts that childhood trauma has on our students' learning, as well as what educators can do. In the next episode, we will be featuring Amber Nichols. Amber is a kindergarten teacher from Monongalia County, and she will be sharing her remote teaching and learning journey with us. You won't want to miss it. Thanks for listening.